The Filipino Donald Trump today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Rodrigo Duterte is running for president of the Philippines. He's brash, controversial, and sometimes lewd.
That's kind of one of the things that where he parallels Trump in a bit. He'll say something shocking and crazy, you know, and then he'll sort of backtrack and apologize for it, and people are like, okay.
Plus, an undocumented immigrant's plans to apply for college get derailed.
So when I realized what that meant and how that would affect my future that I planned, I basically thought about giving up.
But she didn't. And who can forget Bob Marley and the Wailers? Well, Bunny is the last Wailer standing.
Because I didn't leave the Wailers, I'm still here representing the Wailers. I am Bunny Wailer.
And don't you forget it. That's all ahead today on The World. He's offended a lot of voters with his harsh rhetoric. He's openly challenged China. The nation's political establishment thinks he'd be a catastrophe as president, and yet the polls have been smiling on him all the way. I could be talking about Donald Trump, the Republican frontrunner, now all but assured the party's nomination, but I'm actually talking about Rodrigo Duterte. He's the longtime mayor of one of the largest cities in the Philippines, and now he's running for president there. And Duterte is favored to win the vote next week. Reporter Marnette Federis has been following his rise. She's a Filipina-American in Sacramento, California, and a contributor to our Global Nation desk. Marnette says Duterte gets a lot of credit for getting rid of crime in his city, but he's also criticized for how he's done that.
So a lot of what he's been criticized for and what human rights advocates are really alarmed about is his alleged support of these Davao death squads, which is basically groups of people who engage in vigilante killings of criminals. And Duterte himself has joked about, you know, his support of the death squads. And, you know, he's joked about killing people and murdering people and that sort of thing. But a lot of the human rights advocates think, you know, this is really going on. And they're concerned that, you know, as president, whether he was going to continue these kinds of acts.
Does he also insult people?
He does. He's joked about the Catholic Church, which is really interesting because the Catholic Church, as you know, in the Philippines, is such a highly regarded institution. He's joked about the Pope. He's joked about rape. He recalled this rape and murder of an Australian lay minister in the 1980s. And he basically brought it up and talked about how, oh, that woman was beautiful and that he should have been, quote unquote, first. He's also made jokes about being a womanizer and that sort of thing.
As if that's a value for him.
I guess. He definitely has this way of, you know, he'll joke about certain things and then, you know, maybe he'll get criticized for it and he sort of backtracks a little bit. So that's kind of one of the things that where he parallels Trump in a bit. He'll say something shocking and crazy.
And yet he's popular, kind of like Trump is popular, at least for Republicans. Why do people like him?
So one of the things I think that why he appeals to people is that he just seems to be like someone who doesn't care about what other people think. And, you know, while that seems like a negative, a lot of his supporters see him as just someone who's being real. He talks the way ordinary people do, not like a politician. And so Duterte's message of decentralization and getting rid of corrupt individuals in the government is really resonating. And that's what he's all about. He's all about crime. He's all about corruption. And, you know, those two things are very much a part of daily life in the Philippines. And people are tired of it. And they just want someone to come in and shake things up and get rid of crime and corruption.
Wow, the parallels are kind of uncanny. You're Filipino-American. You get to vote in both elections, and you've already voted in the Filipino election. What is it like for you to see these two outsider candidates, Duterte in the Philippines and Trump here in the U.S., doing so well? What is the common link between the two candidates and the two countries right now, do you think?
Yeah, what I've noticed just as I'm, you know, kind of discussing both elections to my own family, my friends, and also the folks that I interviewed in the story, you know, these two elections are really about candidates who are sort of not your ordinary politician. People really love the idea of someone who is an outsider, someone who is not, you know, the refined politician, someone who's not giving speeches to them, but someone who's just really talking straight to them. So in that way, I think both of these candidates, Duterte and Trump, that's basically what they're doing, is that they're not your typical politician. And people like that.
Marnette Federis is a reporter in Sacramento, California. Her story on the Filipino presidential elections was made possible through our Global Nation Reporting Fund. It's a way to bring new voices into the debate about immigration and diversity in the U.S. If you have an idea for a story, head over to PRI.org/Global Nation Stories. Now, here's another Global Nation story. Every month, the U.S. deports thousands of men, women, and children to Guatemala. But they continue to come, or at least they try. Many are fleeing remote villages that were devastated by violence during the country's armed conflict decades ago. Those villages still struggle economically today, and many residents head north to the U.S. looking for a better future. Amy Bracken has our story from one town in Guatemala's northern highlands.
Here in Zacualpa, many locals can't resist a gamble. Get a loan and pay a smuggler thousands of dollars to take you through Mexico to the United States. You might make it and get a job and send much-needed money home to family. Or you might fail, get deported, and end up back here, worse off than you were before. Or you might go missing. In that case, your family is likely to come here, to the convent behind the Church of Zacualpa, where there's a small office marked with a paper sign saying Migration Project. It's a local initiative with outside backing from the Human Rights Center at Boston College. Luisa Hernandez Simach works here. She says most people who stop by are looking for loved ones who've gone north. We've noticed that they don't present themselves, she says. Like, my name is Maria or Juana, and I come from such and such community. The first thing they say is, I'm looking for my migrant family member. They know Hernandez Sima has access to a powerful tool, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Locator website. She plugs in the migrant's name, country of origin, and date of birth. Sometimes their location pops right up.
Sierra Blanca, Texas.
West Texas. West Texas.
This time she scored. But sometimes this turns up nothing, which could mean the smuggler has told the migrant not to use his real name. So Hernandez Simach fills out a form with the migrant's information and submits it to an attorney at Boston College, who checks with her network of attorneys across the U.S. to see if anyone can locate this person. We're so happy when we get a result, Hernandez Simach says. To see he's in detention, here he is, the family knows he's coming home. When, we don't know, but he's coming home. The feeling is relief, of course, because the worst fear is that the loved one is dead. Here in Zacualpa, we have four cases of people who have disappeared, Hernandez Simach says. They've been missing for between 4 and 15 years. And then there's the tragic case of Manuel's family. The 67-year-old farmer first came into the office a few months back, already knowing where his daughter and grandson were. They'd been in an accident in Mexico. The smuggler had lost control of the car trying to evade authorities. Manuel's daughter had just awoken from a coma, and her 8-year-old son was dead. Ananda Simach and I drive out to visit the family. Speaking a mix of Quiche Mayan and Spanish, Ananda Simach asks Manuel to tell me his story. Years ago, Manuel says, his daughter's husband went to the U.S. to find work to support the family. Wife and son were supposed to join him, but unfortunately, it never happened. The first attempt was thwarted by U.S. Border Patrol. On the second try, the accident happened. When Manuel got the news, he asked the Migration Project for help. Staff members worked with churches in Mexico to arrange rides to get his daughter home with her son's remains. Without the churches, Manuel says, forget about it. Back in the convent courtyard outside the Migration Project office, I meet another client, Luis, 21 years old. In a sense, he's lucky. He survived his three attempts to reach the U.S. Each time he was caught by Border Patrol. At that part of the story, he's overcome with emotion and pauses for a while. It helps to talk to the staff here, he says. What happens in the community is one is ashamed to talk about one's failures.
es como un dolor en la gente, pero también es como vergüenza, ¿no?
Ananda Sima sees this all the time. She says people don't talk because of the pain of the debt, but also because they fail to make it through and achieve this quote-unquote American dream. For The World, Amy Bracken, Zacualpa, Guatemala.
Some undocumented migrants do make it to their U.S. destination, though, and then they have to get by without papers. If they are kids when they arrive, it can be tough to apply for college later, even under DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, which allows them to study and work. Many schools don't realize that these students are eligible for admission, but one student in Boston figured out a way to get in. She's from Brazil and crossed the border 12 years ago with her mom and baby sister. She was 7 years old then, and here she is now.
My name is Valeria DeVale. I'm an undocumented student living in Boston, and I just received a full ride to Northeastern University for all 4 years. College was always a dream of mine. I always wanted to attend college. It was something that my mother specifically came to the United States looking for a better education for my sister and I. And so right when we got here, not only did I know I was undocumented, I also knew that my mom and I had this goal, right, together that we would go and she would work and I would attend school and do my best and get good grades. And that's exactly what I did. And by ninth grade, that's when I really understood what being undocumented meant, because at that point, I had a 4.0, had all A's, top student, but there were a lot of programs that I couldn't join because I didn't have a social security number. And so when I realized what that meant and how that would affect my future that I planned, I basically thought about giving up. I broke down. I cried in front of my teacher. Through my mind, it just ran the fact that my mom had worked so hard and sacrificed so much. You know, part of me just wanted some help, like sort of a direction into where I could go. Like, yes, these are some merit scholarships you can compete for and be eligible for. As far as my guidance counselor, I was actually the one who was guiding the guidance counselors about being undocumented and what they had to do. And they actually sent undocumented students to me so that I could actually help them. So as I call these colleges, I just explain to them I'm undocumented, but I have DACA, which means I do have a social. However, a lot of them still consider me as an international student. So the school needs to change in their system the choices in which you can choose. You know, it's not just U.S. citizen, permanent resident, international student. They need to include DACA or undocumented. It's an easy thing to do. It's just a matter of understanding and changing it in their systems. I remember how I would wait late at night to make sure my mom would be coming home. And I would be holding my sister and feeding her her bottle because she was a baby still. It was just, to me, it all felt helpless, and it sort of continued throughout my high school career, and it wasn't until I received this full ride that it really kind of went away. Now it's worth it, and, you know, and now my mom's hard work is worth it, and that, to me, is what matters the most.
Great story. Valeria DeVille will be starting college this fall at Northeastern University here in Boston. She told her story to my colleague, Maria Muriel. You're tuned to The World. They say you don't miss your water till your well runs dry. Well, the wells in India have been running dry for some time due to an ongoing drought there. Now India has to deal with record-breaking temperatures on top of that. Real serious heat. Chavi Sachdev is a journalist in Mumbai, and I just saw what I think is Exhibit A of this heat, Chavi, a video online.
Support for The World's podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. For answers to the world's most pressing economic questions, from the evolution of consumer preferences to the reasons for price swings in the oil market, tune in to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast. Each episode features in-depth discussions with some of the firm's leading experts on the markets, evolving industries, and the global economy. Subscribe to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or listen at gs.com/podcast.
Of a woman literally frying an egg on the ground, and in about a minute she had an omelet. Can you do that in Mumbai today?
Not quite, because I think it takes about 130 degrees Fahrenheit to cook an egg. We've got only 96.
Only 96. Okay. Well, compared to some parts of the country, which, what, hit 126 plus yesterday, that does seem mild. So the drought is driving people from their villages in the countryside into cities like Mumbai. Is that mostly because there's water in Mumbai?
Well, there is water in Mumbai, mostly because we take it at the expense of the places that don't have it.
That exodus from the countryside, it's been happening for years. And meantime, megacities like Mumbai fill up with those people. Where are these new drought refugees living?
Well, they're flocking to the already depressed socioeconomic places, mostly the slums. And the assumption is that they have relatives or other people from their villages there, so they just move towards them. Because these farmers have nothing. Their fields are dry, their crops are not growing, they can't even feed their livestock. Everything is just dying. So then they have to leave, and then they come straight to Bombay.
Yeah, so the assumption is that they're living with relatives. Is that actually the case? I mean, how many of these people end up just homeless on the street?
Many of them. There are people sleeping under the flyovers. There are people working as wage laborers and then just sleeping where they work because there is no room.
So you have some water in Mumbai, but you were recently in the northern part of India near the foothills of the Himalayas. Compare life there to, say, Mumbai.
I was in Dehradun, which is in the foothills, and it's usually a beautiful place for getting away because it's always pleasant, always cool. It was not like that. It was very dusty, very, very dry, and water there was scarce as well. So the people I was visiting, they got water every day for only half an hour, and they had to run around, fill all their buckets so that they had water for drinking, cooking, eating, bathing for the next 23 and a half hours. And part of the reason it was so dry and smoky was because there are forest fires raging in the foothills.
On top of the heat and the drought, there are forest fires.
Yes, and they've been raging for about 90 days, and people have actually died in these fires, which are now reaching cities and schools and towns.
So the drought and heat wave helped cause these wildfires. What impact are the fires having now that they've been burning?
So they're affecting, of course, people's cash crop, which is timber. And also the fires are belching out all this smoke and ash. And this ash cloud is moving towards the glaciers, which are in the Himalayas. And that's the source of the water for the whole country. These glaciers are getting coated with this ash. And scientists are worried that it's actually going to cause the glaciers to melt much, much faster. Because glaciers usually, you know, reflect the light back. Instead, since they're being coated by this soot, they're getting warmer and they're just going to end up causing landslides and floods.
Wow, everything is interconnected, isn't it? So any relief in sight for India?
Well, the meteorologists are predicting a better than before monsoon. We've had three monsoons that have failed, and this is based on statistics. And you know what they say about statistics. So we can't really say until June.
So I know at 91 degrees, it's nowhere near as bad as 126, but are you managing to stay cool in Mumbai?
Well, I am sweating small rivulets, a very attractive sweat right now. But we're lucky. I have electricity. I have running water. I can manage. The rest of my compatriots, not so lucky.
Reporter Chavi Sachdev in Mumbai. Thank you for your time, Chavi.
You're very welcome, Marco.
Sewage treatment is something most of us would rather not deal with or even know much about, but residents of the Gaza Strip don't really have that luxury. That's because the Palestinian territory has a sewage treatment system that is woefully inadequate, and the results are impossible to miss. Yesterday, a reservoir in Gaza overflowed, sending some 10 million gallons of raw waste flooding into nearby farmland. Even on a normal day, there's so much untreated sewage in the territory that millions of gallons of raw waste are released into the ocean. That waste then flows northward, spoiling Gaza beaches and also Israeli beaches further up the coast. Reporter Daniela Cheslow is in Tel Aviv. She reports for the AP there, and she's been writing about this hideous sewage problem. Remind us, Daniela, why Gaza's sewage treatment system is so inadequate.
Well, first you have 1.8 million people living on a very small piece of land. Then you have infrastructure that's really not adequate to deal with their sewage in the first place. And then there's a chronic electricity shortage. There's about 6 hours of power every day in Gaza, which just isn't enough to run sewage plants the way they need. And finally, there's an Israeli and an Egyptian blockade on building materials, which makes it very difficult to get in the supplies that you would need to build new sewage treatment plants. And if you could get in the new supplies to build the new treatment plants, you would have an issue running them because of the lack of electricity.
So what is the effect of all of this on Palestinians who live in Gaza?
So there are something like 90 million liters of raw or partially treated sewage going directly into the water in Gaza. So there are people who had beach houses that were once quite an attractive place to live, for example, in the Shati refugee camp. And now people regret living near the sea because the water is brown. There's mosquitoes at all times of the year. It's an unpleasant place to live in, and there's also deeper implications like sewage that percolates into the groundwater and contaminates the drinking supplies for the area.
I mean, people are getting sick. In your report, there's a woman who goes from hospital to hospital with her children because they're just drinking tap water.
That's right. I mean, to drink purified water, there's actually a whole cottage industry in Gaza of purifying water, and they have to keep on making their technology more and more advanced because there's different issues that come up with the water, now the contamination of the sewage. So you need to be able to afford that kind of purification, and if you can't, then you drink contaminated water and you bear the consequences.
Now, if Israelis could have turned a blind eye to the Gaza sewage problem, it sounds like it's gotten so bad they can't really anymore. What's going on?
It's not quite at the breaking point in terms of the impact on Israel, but what we did discover was that Israel's desalinization plant in Ashkelon, which provides quite a lot of drinking water for the country, had to shut down once in January and once in February because of the quality of the raw water going into the plant. And when you look at a map, Ashkelon is Israel's most southern city. The pollution is coming from only one place. It's coming from Gaza, which is the water flows north. So when we spoke to the Ministry of Environment, they said that the water isn't a health risk. Most of the sewage is actually consumed by algae. But in terms of the functioning of a desalinization plant, or Israelis on the beach were saying that they felt a lot of plastic bags in the water that had been drifting up from the sewage, there are symptoms of this issue. It's just not a life or death situation in Israel the way it can be for some people in Gaza.
I gather there have been efforts to fix this problem over the years. What's taking so long?
It just seems that every possible issue that you could have is making it difficult. The World Bank basically at this point has built a sewage plant. They're waiting for the electricity to turn it on. They can't find a source. And so in the coming months, they were saying they're going to start running this plant on backup diesel-fired generators, even though it's a much more expensive and polluting method. They're trying to at least get some sort of interim measure.
At the end of the day, sewage and water get short shrift in a place like Gaza, I guess.
Yeah, there are many infrastructure challenges in Gaza, and this is one that's pretty dire. But it seems that right now all the solutions are straddling various political and economic divides.
Journalist Daniela Czeslow, who reported on the sewage in Gaza for the AP. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
You're tuned to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Elizabeth Blunt was not a war correspondent with the BBC, but then she ended up in Liberia.
I went through a war with the people of Liberia. I was in the thick of it just as they were in the thick of it.
And now Elizabeth Blunt's got two schools in Liberia named after her. More on that just ahead here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. You could argue that you never really leave the place where you grew up. It has a way of staying with you for the rest of your life. Abebe Hara Goen knows that feeling. He's a physician, an oncologist in Silver Spring, Maryland. But he grew up in Ethiopia, and he lived in Addis Ababa when famine gripped the Horn of Africa back in the 1970s and 80s. He's thinking about that a lot right now as Ethiopia heads into what's known as the lean season. Those are the months between planting and harvesting, when there's not a lot of food around. This year, though, food stocks will be even more meager than usual. That's because the rain stopped and the crops wilted, which means there will be hunger. And Abebe Hara Goen says hunger saps not just the body, but the spirit as well.
Your entire humanity is altered. There is even a smell of famine, which will never leave you, a catastrophe of biblical proportions. It's very hard for me to describe what you feel and reconcile it with what should happen in this world if things worked.
What does hunger actually do to people from what you've seen?
Hunger starts gradually and then builds up and then ultimately, you know, really brings out either the worst or the best in people. The worst is, of course, what happens to children and babies who cannot understand why they cannot eat and why they cannot drink. In a short period of time, people in their 30s develop, you know, gray hair. mothers have to choose, you know, which baby should I save and which one should I sacrifice? I mean, this is a lot of stress. And fathers often forego food to basically give it to their wife and children, sacrificing their life for their families. Mothers do that as well. And then at the same time, you can see, you know, there are people who are totally turned into monsters by starvation and hunger, who are sort of, you know, stealing, fighting for food, and sort of, you know, becoming extremely pathological people.
How does this bring out the best in people?
People share in Ethiopia. That's our culture. You know, we eat together, and sharing is part of our makeup. Sacrifice is part of the heroic deed that many display, but we don't really hear about.
What are you seeing and hearing today about the drought now back home in Ethiopia?
About 10 million people are hungry and 4 million children are at risk. But the world is now totally focused on Syria, and this is not really obvious to most people in the world. And so although, you know, the government is doing its best and organizations like the World Food Program are trying their best, and also, to make things worse, there have been flash floods in the affected areas recently, just yesterday, actually making it difficult for the trucks to reach the hungry people.
So you're talking about flash floods. You're also talking about drought. Are we looking at this current famine and what's happening in Ethiopia as a function of climate change?
Climate change is not a myth. It's a reality. I have seen it in my own lifetime. Mm. I mean, we have never had these cycles of famine when I was growing up as a child.
Your own family fled Ethiopia in the mid-1980s. You are now a successful oncologist who lives in Silver Spring, Maryland. If you don't mind me asking, what is it like for you to be prosperous here and see all this desperation back home?
We started leaving our country not because of the drought, but because of political instability. There are, I don't know, over 100,000 Ethiopians living in the D.C. metro area and doing extremely well. Mm. There are hundreds of physicians that I know, businessmen, restaurants in all over the city. And so money is going back. You know, I think the so-called diaspora population is probably the biggest source of foreign currency for the country, you know, maybe even above that of Ethiopian coffee.
Mm. Wow, that's incredible.
So if it is not the first, maybe it is number two and number three, but a very important source of foreign currency for our country.
You started a fundraising campaign that I gather has been very successful. Much of the money has come in small donations from people you've actually never met. What do you make of that?
It's surprising, you know. I have a very strong following on Facebook, which I started some years back on a whim. And so I have built a large amount of trust among, you know, the people who visit that, that page. So when I asked for donations some months back, I was really overwhelmed. I just cannot tell you what I felt. You know, in a couple of days, hundreds of people were donating a variety of amounts of money. As you said, you know, most of them, you know, small, $20, $50, $100, from all over the world.
It's kind of hard to escape Ethiopia and Silver Spring, Maryland, but is the country kind of still a part of you? How would you describe your connection to this place you grew up in?
I am spiritually, mentally connected to Ethiopia. I feel Ethiopian. I think about Ethiopia day and night. You know, I'm a citizen of this country, but I'm an Ethiopian spiritually. So I worry about Ethiopia. I think about Ethiopia. I live, you know, mentally in Ethiopia. I visit there every year, at least. I love this country. It has given me everything. You know, I was a resident and a member of the faculty of the Harvard Medical School. I don't want to sound ungrateful. I'm very grateful for what I was able to achieve in this country. But it is not Ethiopia.
Yeah, that's for sure. Abebe Haragoen grew up in Ethiopia. He's now an oncologist in Silver Spring, Maryland. He's raising funds as well to help fellow Ethiopians at risk due to the drought in the Horn of Africa. Abebe, thanks so much.
Thank you, Marco.
Let's move across the continent to West Africa now, and a story about schools. As we know, here in the U.S., schools are often named after people, right? Like that school up the road from here, named after certain John Harvard. Well, this happens all over the globe, and our next guest happens to have a school named after her in Liberia.
Well, I don't want to brag. There are actually two schools.
That's former West Africa correspondent for the BBC, Elizabeth Blunt.
It's a long and complicated story, and they are linked. The first one, somebody wrote to me and asked me if I minded. And of course I didn't mind. I was hugely honoured. But then there was a period where there was fighting popping up all over the place. People were invading. Things were getting burnt down. And the people from that village were being chased from pillar to post. And it wasn't at all clear that there really was a school. I got letters sort of once every 18 months, this chap would write again and then disappear. And then people began to say they'd seen a school with my name on it in Monrovia, not in the village. And it turned out that the original people had fled their village when it was attacked. They'd come to Monrovia and someone had let them use their school buildings in the afternoon and they put up their signboard. So that was how it started. And then eventually after the war, they went home, put up another signboard. So now I've got two schools.
Incredible story. I mean, you were covering the Liberian Civil War in the 1990s. Why did they name the school after you, though?
Every school in Liberia is named after somebody. And in 1990, I suddenly got terribly famous. And it was really because there was nothing else to listen to except the BBC. Local stations went off air when they ran out of fuel for their generators. Local newspapers stopped printing when they ran out of newsprint. Normally, people might have listened more to Voice of America, but they just had a change of correspondent and the new one hadn't quite found his feet. And so the BBC stepped into the breach, and that was how people knew what was going on. Even sometimes 10 miles down the road, you had to listen to the BBC to find out. And that's how I got to be famous.
Right. Well, as you've written, it was my own voice which told Liberians that President Doe was dead and his mutilated body put on display. That was a good generation ago. Do you have a sense today how Liberians remember you, aside from this honor of getting two schools named after you? Like, how do the kids know who Elizabeth Blunt is?
The kids at the school only know me as the sort of patron, if you like, of their schools. They're far too young to remember the war. That's a good thing. Older people remember me. I was absolutely astonished. People, we turned up at a small guest house that I'd never heard of upcountry. And there was this wonderful dinner laid on for us, compliments of the management, because they remembered the BBC's reporting in the war.
So you've been to both these schools now. What is the state of education, if you can kind of like play off what you saw in Liberia? And, you know, what do you see? What did you see?
They've both got very severe challenges, different challenges. The original school, the country school, is in a small village. It's a government elementary school, which you'd think would be a good thing. It's rebuilt itself. The villagers have done all the rebuilding and it's looking very nice. But their problem is the teachers. The only person who was on the pre-war payroll is the headmaster. And he's still on the payroll and still being paid. But most people who weren't from that village originally ran away when it was attacked. So after the war, they had to find some other people to teach. And when the government came along to check up, there were people teaching, but they weren't the ones that were on the payroll. And the official said, fine, but you have to be trained before we can pay you. So they sent them off for training. They came back and the government said, sorry, we've got no money. There's a freeze on hiring. We can't put you on the payroll. So now the whole school has only got the headmaster and one other teacher who are officially there and actually being paid. All the others are what they call volunteers, and the villagers have to scrape together a bit of money. Bowlers cost them a lot. And honestly, it doesn't look like getting better anytime very soon.
I was going to say Ebola must have served another massive handicap to Liberia's educational system.
Well, it did. Everybody got poorer. The schools were closed for 9 months. Some people dropped out. Some children dropped out of school and didn't come back. Everything got sort of dusty and abandoned. Our computer room that we'd helped pay for computers down in Monrovia for the junior high school, of a dozen computers, only one is really still working because they were just left uncovered in the dust, in the heat, not touched for 9 months. The mice got into some of them. The damp got into others. So that's just one tiny thing, but it must be happening everywhere.
You know, Liz, one of the problems I've found with journalism is, you know, we go to places like Liberia to cover these really intense stories, civil war, Ebola, name it, and then the journalists go home. Why was it important for you not to just, like, drop off, you know, the map?
Liberia was a bit special because I went through a war with the people of Liberia. I wasn't a war correspondent. It struck me as appalling as it struck them. And I was in the thick of it just as they were in the thick of it. So I think that makes it a bit special, and I wouldn't like to lose that link completely.
Elizabeth Blunt, former West Africa correspondent for our partners at the BBC. Great to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dip back into the past now in Jamaica, late 1963, and a band called The Wailers headed into Studio One in Kingston, backed by a ska big band called The Scatolites. This was not Bob Marley and The Wailers. Those stars had not aligned yet. This was simply a trio called The Wailers, Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, and Bunny Livingston. Bob is gone. Peter Tosh was murdered in 1987. That leaves Bunny the last Wailer standing. And even though the Wailers folded a long time ago, Bunny keeps Wailer as his last name.
Because I didn't leave the Wailers, I'm still here representing the Wailers. Who is representing the Wailers? I am Bunny Wailer.
I met Bunny Wailer a few days ago when he came to Boston during a rare and brief set of dates in the U.S. He's 69 now, and as a performer, he is in great shape. The Wailers, we know now, weren't just any Jamaican pop act. This tune, Simmer Down, was their first single, and it went to number one in Jamaica. It was a message to Kingston gangs, or rude boys, who were on a rampage through the ghettos in the city at the time. From the beginning, the Wailers had a socially conscious edge. They were also a family, literally. That started when Bunny and Bob were toddlers, growing up together in the same Jamaican hill town of Nine Mile.
Myself and Robert Marley attended the same elementary school, you know, and we became members of the same family when my dad had with his mom a daughter called Pearl. And later on, Peter had a son with my sister, Shirley, Andrew Tosh. So the Wailers was and still is a family.
And now Bunny is a scion of the family. It is what it is, he says. He's got only one concern for his family of Wailers.
To me, the family exists, and there's nothing and there's no one to do anything about that. You know, and I just want to make sure that I am doing what is right in playing the ska, rocksteady, and reggae.
In the green room after Bunny's show, Jamaican expats from Boston lined up to see him.
Yeah, for Daron, and Bob gone, and Peter gone.
Peter gone, Bob gone, are you one there?
Yeah.
Yes, bless up, man.
Peter gone, Bob gone, you're the only one there, Bunny. The MC at the show had told the crowd earlier in the evening that when they went home later, not to update their Facebook profile saying they saw a legend. Legend is an overused word, he said. Tell them you heard real reggae. And I can assure you, that's what we heard when we heard Bunny Wailer.
Imagine, after earning billions of euros, sterling and US dollars, reggae music and its pioneering artists have not received even charity. But all reggae bring new money. Put them together and you get reggae new money.
All who love the reggae music, them are royal blood. Reggae blood is thicker than mud. All who love the reggae music, them are royal breed, terminating from the reggae blood sea.
New music there from Bunny Wailer. More music just ahead as we connect the dots between Colombian folk music and author Gabriel Garcia Marquez here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Since the Global Climate Agreement was negotiated in Paris last December, we've heard a lot about the importance of big polluters like the U.S. and China stepping up and actually putting that agreement into force. So it was interesting to hear that one of the first countries to fully commit to the Paris Plan is not a big power. In fact, it's a country that until recently was barely functioning, Somalia.
We used to be called a failed state. Now we call a fragile state. If we can do this, anyone can do.
That's Somali Foreign Minister Absalom Omar. He spoke with us via Skype. Somalia joined more than a dozen small island states in quickly ratifying the Paris Agreement last month. Those island nations are especially vulnerable to sea level rise, and they pushed hard for the agreement back in December. Now Omar says it's his country that wants to send a message.
Somalia is telling the world, stop denying that climate change is here, that the world is changing, and we are the cause of it.
Those changes are hitting Somalia itself hard. The rainy season there just started, but dry conditions since October have been wilting crops and killing livestock. The UN says close to a million Somalis are struggling to get enough food every day. That's partly because of the country's long civil war. But Omar says it's also because of more frequent droughts.
A serious drought in the Horn of Africa used to come around every 10 years. It was a predictable thing. People could get ready for it, and now it's coming every 2 years.
The U.S. military has warned that climate change, a so-called threat multiplier, can contribute to political instability around the world. Omar says that's definitely happening in his country.
It brings instability. It brings people fighting over meager resources of food and water. And I don't want to be blaming everything on the environmental disaster we're facing, but the drought is happening more often because of what we are doing to our environment.
Somalia is a very poor country, not many resources, not much industry. So Omar says it can't do a lot to actually fight climate change at a global level. But everything is interconnected, and the foreign minister says one thing Somalia is trying to do locally is addressing one of their biggest environmental problems, deforestation. Gabriel Garcia Marquez once described his book, 100 Years of Solitude, as a 350-page vallenato. Now, in case you're not familiar with vallenatos, here's our friend Beto Arcos.
Traditional vallenatos are Colombian folk songs played on accordion, caja, a small drum, and guacharaca, a scraper. They're mini-epics about characters from small towns and lyrics filled with poetic imagery about local lore.
And Gabriel Garcia Marquez was a big fan. He even helped to create a vallenato festival that takes place every spring in the Colombian city of Valledupar. Beto went to this year's edition.
You don't have to look far for signs of Gabriel Garcia Marquez's love of vallenato. It's right there in his 2002 memoir, Living to Tell the Tale. I had dreamed about the good life, he wrote, going from fair to fair and singing with an accordion and a good voice, which always seemed to me to be the oldest and happiest way to tell a story. Garcia Marquez would often mention vallenato in his stories, even name-checking a beloved composer, Rafael Escalona. Garcia Marquez made vallenato a central part of his most famous book, 100 Years of Solitude. He turned a real-life vallenato accordionist, Francisco El Hombre, into a mythical balladeer. Here's vallenato historian Tomás Darío Gutiérrez.
García Márquez cogió a Francisco el Hombre y lo sometió.
He says, García Márquez took the real character and processed him through his magical realism. The problem is when people confuse one thing with the other. And people think vallenato began with Francisco el Hombre taking an accordion, a drum, and a guacharaca instrument and traveling all over the region, teaching the music he had invented. Gutiérrez says that story was invented by García Márquez. It's all part of the oral tradition that the novelist was steeped in, says Raymond Williams, professor at UC Riverside, who's written extensively about García Márquez. He says he kept the tradition alive through the book and also through the annual Vallenato Festival, where he was a regular.
It was a happy marriage for him literarily, and it eventually became, you know, a real cultural marriage because he was famous for going to the Festival de Vallenato every year, I guess until he became so famous that he just couldn't do it comfortably anymore.
But that minstrel tradition of vallenato is still very much alive at the festival. I saw some of it when I dropped in on a parranda in the city of Valledupar. These are small gatherings of friends and musicians who sing, tell stories, eat, and drink, Old Parr Whiskey. The one I went to was hosted by the composer Damer Marin. He sang and played guitar, no accordion.
Vengo a contarles la historia de cosas que pasan en nuestra región. Que hay muchos que creen en el diablo, que piden dinero con la condición.
After a while, a well-known vallenato singer arrived, Carlos Mario Zavaleta. And he told me a story. In October 2006, while on tour in Mexico with the group Reyes Vallenatos de Colombia, he was invited to sing at a parranda hosted by the Colombian ambassador in Mexico City. The guest of honor was García Márquez.
Vamos a ver que el señor me empieza a preguntar por Armando Zavaleta, un tío abuelo mío, compositor de la música vallenato.
He started asking me about Armando Zavaleta, a great uncle of mine, a vallenato composer. You cannot imagine the nostalgia I saw on his face. I had no idea how long it had been since he last heard a drum, a guacharaca, an accordion. I will never forget that he asked me, I would love for you to sing La Diosa Coronada. So when he died 2 years ago, I dusted off his books and reread them. And I found the epigraph he included in Love in the Time of Cholera, two verses from La Diosa Coronada. The words I am about to express, they now have their own crowned goddess.
And after he told the story, Zavaleta sang the song, and I cried. For The World, Beto Arcos, Valledupar, Colombia.
Señores, vengo a contarles, hay nuevo encanto en la sabana.
We cover a lot of music on The World. In fact, it's been pretty integral since we started the show more than 20 years ago. We spotlight some of our best stories on Facebook. Just look for Global Hit and get yourselves listening. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Hope you can be with us tomorrow.
Tiene buen adelanto y tiene diosa de los encantos y tiene su corona de reina lo bello.
PRI, Public Radio International.